wow, this is really great, but Jar Jar Binks is really annoying. This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now a co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Ryan Payton. Ryan is the creative director of, was the creative director of Halo 4 and producer of Metal Gear Solid 4 as well. But today, Ryan is the founder of Camouflage, where he's soon to ship the third installment of the critically acclaimed episodic game, Republic. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, guys.
So our episode topic today is episodic games. Of course, a natural fit, Ryan being the founder and... what do you take as your official title? CEO? Lead designer?
No, I avoid the CEO title. I think it's kind of silly. You know, you have like, see on Kickstarter, it's like a two-man store, and it's like, hey, I'm the CEO, co-founder, creative director, designer, and artist on this. I'm like, yeah,
I'm making the
game.
One
of the guys.
Yeah. I'm in the same sort of position. Nigel and I have a software company, and we're co-founders. And when it was two people, having this, the chief operating officer or chief executive officer of, you know, when there's no other officers, the chief officer is not very important.
It's pretty silly.
I totally get that. But you have been working on this game, Republic, for probably 3 years now, I would say.
We're over 3 years now, actually. And probably when all is said and done, I'll be about four, which is pretty long time.
Yeah, it's a pretty long time. But with the, so for anyone who doesn't have, and in the context for Republic hasn't had a chance to play it. It was a Kickstarter a couple of years ago now, and I was actually one of the Kickstarterers.
Oh, well, thank you.
Of the game back when it was sort of at that stage where you had sort of concept art and you had some initial work on the game, but you wanted this push to be able to make a game. And I'm putting words in your mouth, but this is the sense I got from the Kickstarter. You wanted to be able to make a game that was sort of challenging what you could do on a mobile, because it's an iPad and also iPhone as well. I think of it as an iPad game because that's what I have played it on. But you know, not your typical Angry Birds type iPad game. Going, you know, and making a really interesting story with, you know, great, like, you actually have facial capture and voice acting and all these sort of things. So that was what brought my attention to it originally. And since then, you have released just on the verge of, I believe it's the 23rd of October, is that correct, for the third episode?
Yeah, which also marks the first time we'll be not just iOS, but also on Android, on Google Play, and the Amazon.
Awesome. Cool. Already getting off topic, but how is the Android stuff?
Oh, wow. Android's, ask me in about a week once it's out there, and we'll see how people are responding to it. But total different beast. I mean, we can definitely... You feel free to ask any questions about that, because it's such a different world than iOS in terms of like the amount of handsets you have to support. Screen resolutions, all sorts of really crazy things. I mean, and that's part of the reason why we partner with a development team in New York called Dark Wind, and they're handling the majority of the development on Android, so we could focus on iOS and also PC.
Smart. We do iOS and Android apps at Steam Clock, and that's... we've definitely found that there's a lot more demand for Android over the last year or two. So it's something we've been investing in and doing Android apps. And when it's good, but it's a little scary to ship something to the Google Play Store and they ask, which of the 3,500 devices do you support? And you're
like, yeah. And I was really surprised, because I was talking to Matt from Dark Wind like about a week ago. And I had this kind of epiphany as I was driving around about, you know, we kind of painted ourselves into a corner, or I don't know how do you describe it when it comes to Kickstarter. And, you know, back in the day when we were shipping or starting the game in 2011, you know, the iPhone 4 was pretty hot, but not anymore. And, you know, with iOS 8, they don't even support the iPhone 4. So I basically suggested to Dark Wind that we don't support really low end Android devices, seeing that Episode 4 and Episode 5 might not be able to run on them. And I basically said, hey, can you just like filter out all the devices that don't have a gig of RAM? And he said, yeah, but it's going to be maybe a couple of days worth of work to go through, you know, the 1500, you know, different handsets that, we could check off or check on. I mean, it's ridiculous, man. I'm not used to this at all.
And we're in the other way around on iOS, where there's no way to disclude support for, like, there's a lot of games. I actually had an article I was writing this past week about the iPads that they have just released are now like hundreds of times faster, especially in graphics performance, than the original iPad mini, which is now like a 3 or 4 year old device that they're still selling for $249. And games like BioShock have to have this all caps thing saying, do not download on iPad mini. It won't work, please. Because there's no way for them to say we don't support this.
Yeah, it's. I don't really like that policy that Apple has in place. I think developers should be able to discriminate against some of their devices. The only way you can do it is by requiring the latest of the OSs. So, for example, we could lock people out, even though we're not going to. But we're at the moment we're not going to do that. But we could lock people out, iPhone 4 users, by requiring iOS 8. But that's really all we can do at this point. Yeah, and I wish there was a little more freedom to do that, because honestly, at the end of the day, it's not that we don't like those people or whatever. It's just, those devices are really, really old. And here's the other thing. The people that have iPhone 4s, the vast majority of them, know that their devices can't run these high-spec games, and it's just a terrible experience for them. And I think the thing that I lament the most is that the iPad 2 is still by far the most successful used tablet in the world. And I think Apple looks at that as well. So I have a feeling that they're going to be supporting that thing for years to come, which honestly is really holding back the graphical fidelity of games on iPad for the most part.
I guess one of the things with doing what you guys have done and doing something that's episodic and that's over such a long time is, on the one hand, you have the sort of nice, like, oh, well, when we started, those devices were mainstream. So you aimed at that level initially. So you don't have to worry about the, like, oh, well, we, developed the game on all of our brand new iPad Airs, and now we, go back and it doesn't work on the iPad 2s. But on the other hand, it, it holds you back from then taking advantage of that stuff in the later episodes. So either you have to say, well, at some point we're going to cut off these users who the game, the first couple episodes were fine for them, but now, as things have advanced, we want to keep up with other games that are coming out with the, with things like graphical quality and that. So either we got to cut those people off, or you need to pull it back. So you guys are kind of in a even worse situation, I imagine, in that way than some, than a game developer doing a non-episodic game that they, they don't have to worry about pissing off old customers who've already bought the game on those old devices, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We made our bed and we lie in it, in the sense that we've just taken too much time to release all the episodes, and I think we just kind of put ourselves in this position. One kind of fascinating thing is that that Apple's right around this time is releasing two new iPads that we had no idea about, and they did it. They announced it after, like, a day after we submitted episode 3 to the App Store. So our poor intern is going to be standing in line like he usually does for about 7 hours at the Apple Store when those iPads come out, and we're going to take them into the office, and we just kind of cross our fingers and hope that they work. So that's another kind of interesting aspect about, again, like us just kind of waiting for so long to put out each new episode. And yeah, we end up having to support so many different devices. And what's also interesting is, now that we're almost done with PC as well, is that we're trying to unlock a lot of really high spec graphics on the game as well. So we're kind of going we're going on both extremes. Like, we had to make sure that the game runs on iPhone 4, but we also want to make sure that it takes advantage of the latest GeForce graphics card. So it's pretty interesting inside the walls of Camouflage every day, because the team is just getting pulled in so many different directions.
And wider that gap gets in between your lowest spec thing you can support and the highest spec thing you can support, the weirder backflips you need to do, either special cases or just like make strange decisions that, the artists might be like, oh, I have to have this low poly count model, but I guess I can have these crazy cool textures to put on it that will happen on the higher end devices and weird things like that. Which,
yeah, one of the things we built in this over the course of episode 3 was this thing we're just calling platform versioning system, and it's a faster tool to allow the team to basically, just with a checkbox in Unity, check whether something is going to be visible on that platform. One of the examples is with Android, and we have different exclusive content for Android and stuff like that. But like, on a more like relatable level, when we're talking about these kind of performance and stuff like that, we can turn off fog, for example. We have a lot of fog effects and water effects in episode 3, and we just turn them off for lower end devices. So we're getting smarter about it, but it's still like, I have to hire a QA guy just to do performance checks on iPhone 4 and just literally just go through the game and write down what the what the frame rate is every day and give the team an update about how it's doing. So it's it's pretty ridiculous project.
When I was back many years ago as a World of Warcraft addict, and I was playing on this the computer that any game developer would never ever want you to be playing on, which was a white MacBook with integrated GMA 950 graphics, which is like
nice.
Pretty much it was the very first integrated graphics chip that modern 3D games were like, maybe we'll allow you to use that. And we would get into circumstances where there'd be this raid and there'd be like 25 of us or whatever. And people are like, stay out of the electricity. And I'm like, what are you talking about? There's no electricity, because they turned off the effect for the electricity. Card.
That's nuts. Oh, I love it. I have this weird like fetish, for lack of a better term, with like low spec versions of games. Nobody believes me when I say this, but for a while there, I'm not a huge Call of Duty fan, but I would rent the Wii version of like Call of Duty Black Ops 2, and just to see what like the non-textured, like really like the lowest spec version of the game looks like, because you can kind of see how the artists had to build each part. And I just thought it was like a really interesting like technical challenge for those teams, and I kind of imagine what they had to go through. It was very strange. So maybe I find some kind of weird fascination in having to support some of these lower end devices.
Yeah, it's definitely an art. Like I believe Nigel did like a PSP version of a console game at one point, didn't you?
Yeah, I've worked on a couple of PSP games. I did one that was a actual port from like a PS2 Xbox game that didn't end up shipping, but yeah, that was. It wasn't so much a challenge in terms of performance for that one as memory.
Right.
Like the PSP was, I mean, it certainly wasn't comparable to like the, I guess this was an Xbox One PS2 era game. So the PSP definitely wasn't comparable.
Like the original Xbox, not Xbox One. Xbox One.
So confusing.
Oh yeah. Yes. Original Xbox. And, it was like, okay, the CPU is like 50% less, but, we can hack around at. But the real challenge was the memory, that it was going from a 32 gig system down to like an 8 gig system, approximately. I think those were the numbers. It was brutal.
Yeah, no, I had the seminal game for me in my career was this PSP game called Metal Gear Solid Portable Ops. And where we took this Metal Gear Solid 3 engine and had to get it working on PSP. So yeah, we experienced a lot of the same memory issues. And we had a small team. And then, I don't know how many years it was later, maybe 4 or 5 years later, the whole MGS4 team shipped Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker on PSP. And then I could really see just how far they could push that platform. But they had the same constraints that we had on Portable Ops, but just a much larger team, a lot more devs. And it was just such an amazing technical feat to see what they did, but not fun at all. And I know that devs really, really love the fact that they're gonna be able to drop PS3 and Xbox 360 support pretty soon for multi-platform games, so they can really, really take advantage of the memory that these new hardware has.
It's interesting to see sometimes the gap between the games at the start of a platform and the games at the end of a platform. I had two relatively interesting experiences with that recently that I played. Hitman Absolution and then Hitman Blood Money.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Which, Hitman Blood Money was like a Xbox 360 launch title, I think, or very close to launch. And then a couple months later, I played the Bioshock Infinite Burial at Sea DLC, and then went back and played the Bioshock 2 DLC, like right after. And like, even though, if you showed people video of them, they wouldn't believe that they were on the same console.
Yeah, no doubt.
Like you'd be certain that like this thing is, one of these is the Xbox 360 version, one of them's the Xbox One version, or one of them's the original Xbox version, and one of them's the Xbox 360 version. Like it's kind of remarkable, when you start out a platform, you're like, oh, we can just barely cram this thing that, doesn't really look very good in. And then by the time the platform's matured, it's like, oh yeah, this, we're just making something that looks 10 times better than it did, even with the hardware not changing at all.
Sorry, Alan, you were going to say something?
I was, but I'm going to switch to saying something else.
You're
going
to try to bring us back to topic.
I'm going to bring us back to, we'll deviate from talking and come back to the topic every once in a while. But we something I thought was interesting you'd mentioned was this sort of bed that you've made by the season's pass. Or I'm not sure if you specifically mentioned the season's pass, but you're like, okay, we're going to do these episodes, and they're all sort of targeted that the idea that someone who buys the first one hopefully can play through all five, and this idea that, okay, well, maybe people will be trying to play them on the same platform. Maybe they started on iPhone 4, they might want to finish on iPhone 4. But I think that that's like an interesting economic thing for game developers that hasn't existed before, this idea where you have sold a set of kind of five. You don't think of them as five games, but you know, in some ways you can measure them as five games. Mm-hmm. You sell them all up front, and then your bet is, okay, now I got to make these games and I got to ship them. And you'll have different economic pressures than, say, a studio that spent 3 or 4 years building one giant game, and then it's all sort of put it all out on the table, and they either catastrophically fail or it succeeds, but... in that 4 years, they've had no necessarily, they haven't gotten any revenue, at least not from users. So it's I think that's like an interesting thing worth kind of, you know, halfway in, do you feel like that's been a big benefit to the studio, or is it just a different way of doing it?
Yeah, the season pass has been a really big success for us. It's by far our most successful DLC, like in-app purchase.
Oh, awesome.
Which at $15 is pretty remarkable. In fact, I have some theories about this, but one of the interesting stats that we like to talk about is that we have more people who have bought the season pass than have finished episode one, which is I have some theories about that, but I think it just goes to show that I think people like what we're doing, and that one of the things I really tried to do early on was try to not only offer a season pass, you know, basically a discount for pre-purchasing episodes 2, 3, 4, and 5. But in addition to just doing that and getting a cheaper price, is to add some benefits, kind of like what PlayStation Plus was kind of doing, is adding more and more value to the service. So, you know, we unlock the developer commentary if you buy the season pass. You know, at one point we're giving early access to future episodes if you get the season pass. There's a couple other things I think we throw in there, and we just try to push everybody into there because. I think it's like the ultimate experience. It's cheaper for them, and it helps us, you know, on the business side in terms of revenue for sure.
So now that you're in that circumstance where you have a lot of people buying the season's pass, as well as people who did the Kickstarter, or at least to a certain level that you would get the season's pass as part of that, do you feel like your relationship with fans has changed compared to other games, where instead of this thing where fans are excited to maybe play the game, they're people who have already paid for it and maybe have some sense of entitlement?
Yeah, I mean, they have a... Yeah, the folks that have the season pass definitely, rightfully so, have a sense of entitlement because they basically purchased stuff that you haven't delivered, and when you say that you're going to be delivering new episodes every 4 months, you better damn well do that. And that being said, episode 3 has taken us about an extra 6 weeks to put out. We started in earnest beginning of May, and now you know late October it's finally coming out. So. It sucks, and I feel bad for the folks that are frustrated. But at the end of the day, I always try to tell the team that if from a community perspective, if the biggest complaint is that they want the episodes and they can't wait for them and they want them faster and faster, then that's probably the best kind of negative criticism that we can get. The worst would be just apathy and silence. So that being said, like, I don't think it's good that we're taking as long as we are, and I hope that we can turn it around with episode 4 and episode 5. But we definitely feel the pressure because we've taken people's money, and we feel this obligation to deliver the best product possible.
Well, look how fans of the Half-Life series treat episode 3, like as if their child has been stolen from them because Valve hasn't made a game that they sort of. I don't know if they ever even explicitly said there would be... Did they say explicitly there would be 3 episodes and then they just haven't gotten to the third one?
They, I believe, at one point explicitly said there would be an episode 3. And, I mean, episode 2's got a pretty huge cliffhanger at the end of it. Like, it's definitely structured as a episodic game that's intended to be followed up relatively quickly as opposed to something that, I mean, it's been, what, like... 4 or 5 years, something
I think it's
like
been
that.
More than that.
Maybe even
it's been
longer.
I want to say it's been like 7.
Yeah, I mean, I've stopped caring about that so much. I don't even remember how long.
As somebody who lives in episodic every day, all day, and thinks about it, I actually just put a big asterisk next to the Half-Life episodes because I didn't it was an early experiment, and I feel like the whole episodic phenomenon has really shifted and changed since then.
Half-Life Episode 3 was 7 years ago this month. Episode 2, rather. Episode 2. Yep. So the gap in between games is now like past multiple console generations.
Mm-hmm. We got to let that one go. But there's plenty of more recent examples in terms of like, you know, failures and successes. And episodic is just such a fascinating model of development and distribution.
So do you think there's any particularly fascinating failures or successes?
Obviously, the best one is in terms of success and people really getting into the whole idea, I think, of episodic and proving that it is a viable model is The Walking Dead. We looked directly at what they did and straight up copied it. So 5 episodes, $5 a piece, season pass, the whole bit. I really liked The Wolf Among Us, especially the earlier episodes. And I think, yeah, there's just no indication that Telltale is going to be slowing down anytime soon. So yeah, we really look closely to them. But Kentucky Route Zero is another one of my favorite episodic games or game series. But there's also some interesting failures and experiments. One interesting phenomenon that I'm able to kind of tell is that some games start off as episodic, and then the publishers will get cold feet for some really good reasons, and then just ship the whole thing as a single package. And then you also see instances where, you know, the publisher will get nervous about shipping the whole thing as a single package and then sell them as episodes, like in the case of Siren on PlayStation 3 back in the day. And what we're also seeing with Resident Evil Revelations is a game that was shipped as a single package but built as an episodic experience. And now they're doing the inverse with the sequel that's coming out in February, where they finished the whole game and now they're just going to ship each new episode every single week to see how that goes. And I just love it because I just want to see more experimentation in that space and see, you know, how we can benefit from, you know, their successes or failures.
Yeah, that frequency is interesting because, I mean, the way that you're doing with Republic, you're building them. Sorry, it takes a few months to build, so they come out every few months. But then we look at TV and like they're not filming an episode of Game of Thrones in a week, but they're releasing them every week in order to sort of get people that are fill and sort of meeting it out. I almost feel like, although I don't know if this is for sure the case, I know that some shows have done this, that they could release every episode of Game of Thrones all at once in one big whack. And then sort of we could just download as we wanted. I think the Netflix.
I think Game of Thrones is pretty unusual that way, though, because it's an unusually structured show and it's got a lot more like location shooting in unusual locations and complicated effect shots and stuff like that. Like, I think a lot of conventional network TV shows are pretty close to a week to shoot, like that they start shooting the series like a month or two, maybe even a little more before the season is going to start. And then basically they're just like 4 or 5 episodes ahead, throughout the whole production of the series. And so like end to end, each individual show is going to take a couple weeks to produce, but you know, it's different people working on it, that it'll be, you know, the cast and the director will get together and shoot one episode, and then the director will go off and edit that episode while a new director comes in with the cast to shoot the next episode and stuff like that. And I think that's a more normal production process for episodic TV shows than how Game of Thrones, which I think I've heard that as well, that it's shot more like a, you know, like 12-hour movie that then they go and edit it into TV shows after the fact.
Yeah, like House of Cards, Orange is the New Black. Yeah, they just put together I don't know how many, like 14, 16 episodes, and then they release them all on the same day, which is also an interesting model as well and something we've thought about.
Yeah, there's definitely pros and cons to that from both TV and games, in that if you have something being released on a regular cycle, whether it's Game of Thrones or a TV show or a game, there is that sort of social cycle of people being like, oh, have you played episode 3 yet? Have you played episode 4 yet? Or, oh, I'm looking forward to the next one. Or what do you think? Like, you're this cliffhanger. We can all just talk about that same cliffhanger because the next one isn't out yet, so I can guess that you're potentially there. Whereas Orange is the New Black, it's all kind of blah. And although nowadays binge watching of TV is probably a little more common than it is, maybe binge playing of episodic games will be the next similar.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I really struggle with because Netflix seems pretty confident in their model about just releasing all the episodes all in the same day. But I'm with you. I like the water cooler aspect of episodic. But that being said, what I've learned, and I had a theory that I pitched to the Telltale guys recently on a PAX panel that we did, and they basically confirmed that the theory, at least that they believe it to be true, is that a lot of users wait until episode 5 is out so they can binge it, and they also want to see just the reception to it. So the most important episodes really are episodes 1 and episodes 5.
Right.
You know, you want to get people hooked into it. You want to get them excited. The torchbearers who are going to be following you throughout the entire experience, and then there's a lot of fence sitters. Even guys, I think the people, for example, who bought the season pass but never finished episode 1 in our case, and I think in the case of their games as well, who are just, they're bought in. They loved episode 1 of Wolf Among Us like I did, and I waited until episode 5 was out partly because I'm busy. The other thing is I got a terrible memory, so I can't remember what happens in between each episode, and I kind of just want to play a new episode every other day, for example, and sit down and enjoy it. So, yeah, it feels like we're still kind of in the infancy of this whole experiment, and as long as anybody who's doing episodic content is creating quality stuff that people like, and staying in business, and most importantly, not screwing up and folding and leaving people with like unfinished season passes. I think this experiment's going to continue, and I really like that. I like more diversity in terms of how we're thinking about monetization.
As a viewer, I have a like strong aversion to this sort of I can play part of it now, but then can't see the rest of it. Like I'm kind of more of a movie sort of person, you know. Like I like sitting down and, you know, playing through something and being done with it, and then not having to think about it again. And I tend to get kind of frustrated. You know, I can see where people that do that are like, oh, I'm not going to play. I mean, I will sometimes play episodic stuff or read episodic books or, you know, watch TV shows or whatever that haven't completed, but I definitely don't like it as much as I like sitting down and, you know, playing a 10-hour game start to finish and then being done with it, or a 20-hour game or watching a movie. I mean, I had a hard time getting going on Republic. Like Alan recommended it to me, a couple months ago at least, and I downloaded it and started playing, and I was like, yeah, this is pretty good, I'm enjoying it, but I'm not sure how I feel about finishing this episode and then not getting to see what comes next. And so I'd fallen out of playing it and then hadn't picked it back up again and actually finished episode 1 until, you know, the guy who made it's coming on the podcast, so I better have at least finished episode 1. But I mean, definitely that was, and I kind of did the same thing with the Telltale's Monkey Island reboot, which I have not finished playing. Like it, I got the first 2 episodes of it, and then just kind of like it never grabbed me enough that I was willing to get involved in it and come back.
Yeah, I think what we're finding is that people have different, you know, viewing habits or playing habits, and you know, some models fit to some folks, and the thing I really like, again, what the Telltale guys are doing, and I think where they're moving forward to, I think is probably the best of both worlds, is that they are with Borderlands and with Game of Thrones, they're going to be moving into, I think, monthly releases of each of their games. So my suspicion is that they're just going to have a longer production cycle, make sure that the episodes are much further along before they release episode 1, make sure that one's coming out at a monthly cadence. So for the folks who like the water cooler talk, to like to hypothesize and love the cliffhangers and love that community aspect of it, can get that enjoyment out of it. But you know, if you're a fence sitter, then you know, with that within, you know, 4 or 5 months, you'll have a whole package disc version of the game for, you know, that's 20 hours that you can sit there and enjoy. I really do feel like that's the best of both worlds, and I wish we were there. You know, I wish I had a much larger team. And we could do Republic episodes every month, because I feel like, again, like that would probably serve both masters potentially.
Yeah, the only downside I see of that approach is that with the building an episode, releasing the episode, and then starting to build the next one approach, then you get more iteration in between the episodes and feedback from people. Yeah. Like obviously you're doing playtesting and getting feedback from people, but if you are building episode 5 by the time you release episode 1, and people are like, wow, this is really great, but Jar Jar Binks is really annoying, then you can't remove him from the second one.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And again, on that PAX panel, the Telltale guys were talking about this specifically. I forget the name of the character in the first season episode of Walking Dead, and I won't spoil it, but I wish I could remember his name, but they purposely made him very annoying, and they thought that people were going to basically kill him off, vote him basically off the island in episode 2 or something like that. And they found that most people didn't like kick him off the island, that they included him in their group. And then the next episode, they found that people still were keeping him in their group, even though they made him more annoying. And they basically just decided to keep him, make him more of like a mainline character because of the way that people were reacting, and that they had that stat tracking and stuff like that, which is exactly to your point, Alan. And yeah, we take user feedback like really, really seriously. And we design each episode based on what people are saying. So for example, in episode 1, I think there might be a little bit of effect of The Room as well, in terms of being such a great big phenomenon on the App Store. People said that they wanted more puzzles in episode 1. So we went and said, okay, cool. So we'll have stealth action, but a lot more puzzles in episode 2. And now we got this feedback that people really liked the combat in episode 2. So we want episode 3 to be more combat driven. And that's really aligned with what we wanted to do anyway. So we kind of doubled down on that. So it's a really fun way to make a game, but it's also extremely exhausting.
Yeah, for sure. So we've mentioned them a number of times, not surprisingly, but it's worth, for anyone who's not familiar with Telltale, they're a game studio that I think of as pretty small, but apparently they actually have like 150 or something people.
They've got to be at least 250.
Oh, okay. So they're huge. Not Activision size, but they're a studio that focuses almost exclusively, as far as I know, on episodic games, and they are this sort of standout success in this genre. They've done games like we've mentioned, the Walking Dead games. They've done various licensed properties like Jurassic Park and CSI, and then the Sam and Max games, Strong Bad's Cool Game for Attractive People, and these sorts of things. And they're working on Game of Thrones, which I'm excited about because I love Game of Thrones. It's sort of interesting how I can't think of another genre where, and not that episodic is a genre as much as like the sort of kind of graphic adventure games that they use for this episodic flavor. Telltale seems to like be the only game studio that owns like more than half of an entire genre that I can think of, as far as like sales. Like, you know, The Walking Dead once supposedly had more than 28 million episodes sold. Which has got to be like a pretty big chunk of that market, at least in that year or whatever, or over that time period. What do you guys think has caused them to be so successful in a genre where there is not as many studios tackling that? Is it that they're really good at it? Is that other people are bad at it? Is it that people are ignoring that genre?
As somebody who looks at that series pretty closely and, mostly for the sake of our studio and trying to make sure that, you know, we're building our games very, smartly and we're monetizing well. And, we piggyback on people's expectations now of episodic and pricing. Like, Telltale's done a great job of educating people, like what episodic can be like. And I think it behooves us to follow that, to not confuse customers with like a 6-part episode or a 4-part series and stuff like that. But to answer your question, I think it's kind of, some of it is lightning in a bottle. I think they're really lucky in the sense that The Walking Dead just became this crazy cable TV hit. I think it was like the number one watched cable TV show, at least at one point. I'm not sure if that's still the case. Just a huge cultural phenomenon, like, there's the whole zombie genre and everything. Everything just seemed to come together for those guys. They were all also just really relentless in terms of the pursuit of episodic and making it work. You know, they experimented with different numbers of episodes and such. And then there's the level of quality of the writing in season 1 of The Walking Dead, I think is a huge factor. I mean, if you look at the previous games like Back to the Future and Jurassic Park, the quality was significantly lower. I think all those kind of things combined seem to, and that plus another kind of serendipitous thing was in 2012 when The Walking Dead season 5 came out. I think 2012 ended up being a really weak year for games, and they basically swept them and Journey swept the Game of the Year awards. I think that really worked in their favor as well.
I think something else you can't discount with Telltale is the quality of the licenses that they've gotten associated with and how well they've used them. Like, they've been part of the recent trick of kind of turning licensed content around. We talked about that in the context of, you know, Batman Arkham Asylum before as being like, you know, a game that was one of the first ones to really do licensed content well. And Telltale's kind of in that same, you know, that same space that they've picked licenses that people really like. And I think pretty much, I guess Wolf Among Us is original, but certainly the vast majority of their stuff is either, you know, licensed stuff from TV or movies or reboots of, you know, well-known adventure franchises from the past that people have a lot of nostalgia for. So they've, you know, with that, they've got this great hook of, you know, people aren't necessarily going to want to play an adventure game that's just about zombies, but a Walking Dead game, people will pay attention to it that wouldn't necessarily have, you know, have paid attention to it if it was just some generic zombie concept that they'd come up with themselves. And I think that, you know, that's a really important part of what's made them successful the last little while.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, and I think you can see that The Wolf Among Us was not nearly the hit that The Walking Dead was, even though that is an established IP, but just not as big as The Walking Dead was. I think it was based on a Vertigo property called Fables. But the another really core element, and I think I totally agree with you, Nigel, about the IP will bring users in, more casual users. You know, being on iOS early on for Walking Dead, I think, was essential, and having episode one eventually go free. And now you're bringing in tens of millions of people that know about the property, know about the TV show, and are willing to come in. And this is where you get to the core, one of the core tenets of Telltale Games, and one of the reasons why they're so successful is, and one of the reasons why we are not as successful as them, is the ease of use and the ability to finish each episode in their games is so much higher than a game like Republic, a stealth action game that can lead to some frustration. Is somewhat skill based, but with Walking Dead, and again, you can tell I have lots of reverence for those guys. So I mean, no, zero disrespect, but I mean, I think a monkey could probably, like, you know, pound his way through a Walking Dead episode if he wanted to, which you can never do that. You know, with a galaxy full of a million monkeys typing away at Republic, probably couldn't finish that. But the Walking Dead games, yeah, you could, even casual users, all you're doing is making these quick choices, right? And these kind of quick time events. And even if you fail, sometimes, oftentimes you kind of continue on, and it just hooks people and lets them get into deeper episodes where, you know, again, back to our game, we've got an uphill battle in terms of making sure that our game is much more broad, despite the fact that it's a stealth action that requires a certain element of skill.
Yeah, I'm super curious about a couple of the sort of lead people on that Walking Dead, specifically season one. Sean Vanneman and Jake Rodkin went on to start Campo Santo, which is a game studio that's doing a totally new game that's not, as far as anyone can tell from the sort of trailers and limited gameplay that they've shown, it's called Firewatch, but it's not as constrained as the sort of Telltale adventure games are. You can wander around, you can fall off stuff, things can go wrong. I'm excited to see what they're able to come up with to, they're obviously people who care really strongly about storytelling, and their ability to tell stories is one of their big strengths, how they marry that with a gamier game, so to speak.
Yeah. And that's the stuff I'm more interested in. I've really grown tired of, you know, here's a choice A, choice B, you know, and having the illusion of choice. Because when you start to dissect a lot of these games, there's very little like player agency in them. And the trick is really making them think that they have, that they're making a difficult choice. And that's why I think that's part of the reason why you see the Campo Santo guys go in that direction. And even with our game, we're trying to have a little more dynamicism in terms of like listening to what players are doing, what they're indicating through their play style, and how that kind of shifts the story around. Especially in episode three, we've experimented with some of that stuff again, because I don't like the, you know, the red pill, blue pill type of design.
Yeah, and that stuff always, this has come up a few times in throughout the life of this show, but we talk about this tension in between giving the player actual choice and then the infinite explosion of probabilistic outcomes you need to then program into your game.
Super hard, man, but it's the holy grail. And I think a lot of these games that are coming out and that these experiments that we're doing, I think is really positive. And I think it's, you know, for example, like the stuff that Ken Levine's talking about doing with his next game. You know, I talked to him a little bit and also went to a session for his narrative, what was he calling it? Like narrative Lego game concept. I mean, it's wild. It's out there stuff, and making it a lot more systemic and and who knows? I really hope that they can ship that thing, because it sounds very ambitious, but it seems like it's a good next step.
And there's definitely history there in terms of things becoming more systemic. Mm. Like, you know, my time in the industry sort of spanned gameplay moving from much more hard-coded to being much more systemic, mm. right? That, like, when, you know, when I started in the industry, the idea of, like, just having a physics system that you try to do things with was, you know, was kind of comical. Like, if you used a physics system, it was for glitz, and then, you know, physics systems got better and games got more like, all right, well, we can just, you know, we can do the kind of things that, like, Trespasser tried and failed to do, of like making people solve puzzles with physics objects. Like, now the physics systems are stable enough, and, you know, you moving from the, like, everything's just on a rail, you know, you're just like walking from the left of the screen to the right of the screen, and then it's like, okay, now it's just this open world, and you can kind of wander around, and the world tries to respond to you. And that, you know, that happened in gameplay over, like, the last decade or so, but it still hasn't really happened in narrative. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at there, is that that's like the next jump for games, is trying to make, you know, make narratives that can match the kind of open-endedness that we've gotten to with gameplay, and, you know, create something new in that respect, rather than having the, like, string of pearls model that lots of open-ended games tend to follow now, where there's openness, and then there's a choke point where you get the next piece of the story given to you, and then you're in the next open right. area, and you get a certain amount of freedom, and then you're narrowed down again everyone gets the gameplay or the story beats in the same order and presented in the same way, and it's just the gameplay that's open.
Right. Yeah, I know, exactly. And I makes me really excited for where we're headed, you know. And and you know, here's the thing. I think even a small team could really tackle this in an interesting way. And I'm, you know, with like, you know, the availability of tools like Unity and Unreal, I'm just really hoping that we see more and more experimentation in this in the coming years.
Yeah, for sure. It'd be interesting. I mean, the industry seems to, I mean, I guess maybe Telltale caused this in a lot of ways, but this 5 episodes is the standard. But it'd be interesting to see over the next coming years whether or not that expands. Like, do you think there's anything magical about 5, or that's, I mean, I guess Shakespeare's were 5 acts, so mm-hmm. it's not totally random as a number of things to break a story into, but
5 feels really good to me. And again, the most important thing is that it doesn't confuse users, because they're getting used to the idea of 5 episodes. And then the whole idea of season pass, like, I think we're too early to start confusing users in terms of, okay, here's a season pass for this 6-part episodic game and this 3-part episodic game. Let's just first teach them about the idea of the 5 episodes structure. And then, you know, in a couple of years, once they're used to it, we can start throwing some curveballs at them. But that's my take, because we still get questions all the time about what's a season pass, you know, and I know the Telltale guys get confused about that too. And they'll buy a season pass and say, wait, where are the other episodes? And they say, no, you've pre-ordered them. They're coming soon. Then you'll download them and they're kind of free from that point on. And people are still confused to this day. So,
yeah, hopefully things like iTunes and stuff offering seasons passes also educate some people, but obviously it's not a complete solution.
Oh man. Yeah. I think we got a long way to go.
One interesting thing about the narrative structure of episodic content and that sort of interests me, like, I don't know whether or not it's a problem, but I'm curious to know if it's something you guys have encountered, is the thing that would kind of worry me about something like, you know, like doing an episodic game is painting yourself into a corner in some respects, right? Like, the when you guys shipped episode 1, that sort of became part of the canon of, you know, of what your world was. And now, you know, a couple years, well, I guess not a couple years later, that you're, you know, with like almost a year later, something mm-hmm. like that, that, you know, you guys are shipping episode 3 and starting playing on episode 4. Like, are there things that you now regret having done in episode 1 because you want to go in a different direction? Or is it, you know, or did you have things planned out carefully enough in advance? Like, you know, to compare to something like episodic television, you know, we talked about the production schedule for television of them generally making the episodes you know, sometimes making the episodes like just a little ahead of when people are seeing them. But from what I understand, that's not how it works with scripts, right? Like you sit down and write the scripts for a whole,
right.
a whole TV series at once. And like the writers kind of break all the scripts and get them all written. And then you say, all right, we've got the season. Now we'll start filming it. And, but you can see the same thing happening with TV, like episode to episode. I mean, there's some TV shows that have kind of famously or infamously had strong seasons and then just kind of completely gone off the rails in later seasons because, you know, clearly the creators didn't expect the things that were popular with the audience to be popular or didn't really know what they were going to do with some of the things they'd set up. So how have you guys found that experience of having, you know, you're kind of in some sense making a whole like 15, 20 hour game. It's just, you have to release part of it before you finish the other parts.
Yeah. I mean, I think it gets back to like, I think that in terms of the integrity of the script, probably the best approach is to get further along in these episodes before you ship episode one. And 9 times out of 10, I'm happy that we released episode one when we did, and I don't regret anything that we put in there, which I think we're kind of lucky, but also, you know, we try to stay flexible. But we also, you know, we wrote a lot of the future episodes beforehand. At least we knew where things were going, and I think that's really important. I'm glad that we're not kind of making up as we go. I think if you're smart about it, and I think for the most part we were pretty smart about how we designed at least the story for each episode, then it could work out. But yeah, if you're just like, hey, we just got to ship this first episode, this is kind of, we'll figure out a way to pay off these things later on. You can kind of get into some trouble. But we've been pretty lucky that way.
Not falling into the lost trap.
No, that's exactly the one I think about all the time, right? It's like, we don't know how we're going to pay this off, but you know, we're smart guys. We'll figure it out. No, for the most part, I mean, I've known how the game was going to end since before we shipped episode one. And I think that's really important that we have that kind of goalpost and we know where we're headed.
It's kind of interesting, at least I think, that one of the central mysteries of it is who exactly the player is. Like, I find that kind of fascinating. I mean, I don't know how, you know, to what degree that's intentional or there is going to be some big revelation about it later on, but it seems it's a very unusual decision. Of usually you're focused on, you know, giving the player their character, whereas in, you know, in this game you're the enigma, like you're the person who, like, you can kind of understand why, you know, both the, you know, the like protagonist Hope, who you know, you sort of start to get a sense of her character and you get a sense of the antagonist, but that's not actually who you're playing. You're playing someone else who's observing this stuff and you don't know anything about who they are or what their actual allegiances are or anything, which is kind of weird.
You know, it's very weird. And honestly, it's not really intentional. I have a kind of a personal policy that I don't really talk about the actual story in terms of like giving people hints or like, hey, this is why we did this with this character or whatever. I like them to kind of figure it out for themselves, but I do make one exception. And I, even at one point I thought about breaking the fourth wall and having like a UI element pop up at the beginning of the game to basically tell players that, you are you. You are playing as Nigel. You are playing as Alan. You are playing as Ryan. And I wanted to make this a true first-person game to basically just kind of put you into the narrative. So there really is, the one thing I'll reveal about the story early on is that there is no enigma. There's no like reveal like, oh, at the end of the day, you're this Cooper character or you are the bad guy or whatever. There's really none of that. And the reason for that is because I did a lot of thought experiments when I was at Microsoft working on Halo about my discomfort and just general what I just don't like about mostly third person narratives but also first person narratives in terms of like who I'm supposed to be. And I get really confused oftentimes when I'm playing games because am I supposed to be me? In the case of I think games that do a pretty good job of that are Fallout and you know Skyrim and those series, but then there's other games that make you are Samus in Metroid Prime, right? You are Master Chief in Halo. You are Vin Diesel or you're Riddick, right? In the Riddick games. And do I have to play like them? Do I have to think and do I have to act like they would act? Isn't that more believable or am I supposed to be myself? So in this game, I really wanted the third person character, Hope, to be her own person and the player to be themselves and then try to tell a narrative that I think that's the most pure form of game storytelling. And I'm not going to spoil any of what happens in The Last of Us, but there are often times when you're playing the game and Joel does things that you might not agree with, and I get really, really confused, and I don't know how to handle that, because again, it gets back to the idea of like, who am I supposed to be? How am I supposed to play this game?
I think that message that you are you and you've sort of, I guess, hacked into some system that allows you to do whatever you do, or at least that's the way I justify it to myself, came across in the Kickstarter video, because I believe like I had a good sense of that, but I'm not sure if Nigel saw that. And so he just picked up the game as a, hey, you should play this video. Because I think there was something in that video, maybe an interview or whatever, where you expressed that idea where you sort of, that there was that sense that you're the person who is doing this, who's controlling this stuff remotely. And it has that feel to it, to me, playing it. So I think that,
No doubt.
Awesome. So I think that's a... excellent coverage of episodic games and some of the fun and interesting things about that way of developing software. How can people find more about yourself and what you're working on, Ryan?
Yeah, probably the best place is on the iOS App Store, Google Play, the Amazon App Store. Yeah, Republic episodes 1, 2, and 3 are available on all those marketplaces on October 23rd, and then we have our own podcast. It's called Camouflage Radio, where we talk really openly and honestly about the development. It's kind of a monthly postmortem for the team, and we don't really censor it at all. We just talk about Unity, we talk about development, we talk about what worked, what didn't work, and it's a really great outlet for the team and also for listeners who like a little bit more nitty gritty game development talk. We're on Twitter and Facebook and all that other stuff, but most importantly for me is just people just enjoying our game. I try to stay out of that limelight as much as I can, because I'm just here like with the rest of the team here in Seattle, just putting our heart and soul into this game, and we're really excited to see what people think about episode 3, and we're already hard at work at episode 4 and 5, and looking to really pay this whole sucker off and make the best game possible, and really turn a lot of heads, especially once we wrap up this narrative. I think people are going to really take notice of what we're doing. I'm really excited for that.
Awesome. Well, I'll link those up in the show notes. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We also want to know what you think, so please give us some feedback. You can send us an email, hello@upup.fm, or leave a rating on the iTunes Store, and see you next week. Have you actually had a chance to play any games recently while you've been busy shipping your own game?
Yeah, it's probably old news by now, but there's one. I've been so busy, but yeah, I do make time every day to go home, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, midnight, and I'll play an hour of Destiny every night. I'll play the daily. I'll play, another strike or two and get some bounties. And I play with the same guys. I play with one of our Kickstarter backers, actually. I met through Kickstarter, which is pretty cool. And then one of our designers. And we make a 3-person fire team, and we just play every night. And I look forward to that every single night. It's just been just a great break from what we're doing. And I love the game, and really excited for that franchise. So that's the only thing I've been playing, really.
So I guess you have a special, maybe, did you have any... So Halo came... branched off from Bungie, and Halo 4 was developed entirely at Microsoft.
Correct.
And then Bungie went off to build Halo. Is there any sort of like residual, either sort of, do you have any emotional attachment to that common lineage, or for you, is it just another game?
No, yeah, I think you're right. I think there is something be said. I mean, in fact, I live very close to the studio, and I can literally see Bungie right now. I'm looking at their building as I'm talking to you. So, I know those guys very well, and, Jonty and the Pete Parsons and all those guys over there. I've been rooting for them ever since I joined Microsoft, even though it was very uncomfortable in the sense that, I was the 10th person at 343, where we were just, we were the new shepherds of the Halo franchise. And we took this thing that Bungie had put their heart and souls into for, over a decade. And there was a lot of pressure, and like having to get, sped up on their fiction and where to take the franchise was it was a lot of fun, but it was a ton of work. And as I dug more and more into the design documents, as I learned more and more about Halo, I just gained more respect for what the guys at Bungie and what they're really about and what their ambitions are. and I can just feel it every time I play Destiny, and it's inspiration for me. Those guys did not take the safe route. I know, like, cynical people would look, oh, it's a sci-fi shooter and it's got PvP and it's got firefight and, like, what are you talking about, Ryan? But you look at that game from a systems perspective, like the things that they built, it's a really risky game. As much as the community likes to point out stuff that they don't like about the game, I have stuff I don't like about the game, but as a whole, it's such an accomplishment. And I hope those guys are feeling really good about it, because I think it's really great.
Yeah, I definitely need to get together a fire team, because I've been playing through the storyline missions and playing through the sort of solo content stuff. Whereas the people who I've talked to who have been most just like really loving the game are the people who are playing on a semi-regular basis with either different people that they know, or ideally like two other people they know, three of them, they make a fire team, they go, they kick butt, they've got voice chat, you know, maybe they have a beer after work or whatever, and do that. And I think that's probably not surprisingly from the sort of heritage of Halo and stuff like that, where the game shines most.
Oh yeah. And the thing that we're most excited about is doing the raid. We expect it to take between 4 to 6 hours the first time we do it. And you have to do it with five other friends. You can't just matchmake that. So we have like email threads going with friends, trying to collect and say, okay, we're going to do it this Saturday. We're going to do it this next Saturday. Who's ready? Who's not? Like, hurry up, you know? We're going to make a total event of that. And I know that for people on the PC side, maybe people playing like, you know, World of Warcraft on a crappy MacBook have experienced that, very commonly. But on the console, this whole idea of doing a raid and setting something up for that and the kind of seamless way that Bungie is doing it is really remarkable. And again, like, super excited about that once we find the time to do it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to bring. I can't think of a console game that ever had that idea of raiding. Like, definitely you can make there's some co-op stuff, but the putting together a team of six people and going through something that takes 5 or 6 hours as a sort of accomplish this thing, as opposed to just going through narrative content. It's a new thing as far as I know.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the only thing I think of is I remember going back home after I was in college. I bought Gran Turismo 2, and there was, I can't remember the names of the courses, but there were some like stupid challenges they had where, like, hey, you know, do like 100 laps on this one course. And of course they didn't remix the soundtrack during it. It's just the same song. So I have like Dragula stuck in my head forever, and the Stone Temple Pilots song that I don't remember the name of it, but it's just you would just play for hours and hours and hours on the same course. That's the only thing I could think of, but it was a solo experience. It was very sad, and I kind of wasted my whole Christmas break doing that. So I'm glad that it seems like the raid and Destiny will be a little bit more dynamic.
It sounds too ridiculous, but I think it's only just barely ridiculous. It might be an accurate memory, but I seem to remember one of the old Gran Turismo games at some point had one of the like challenges it invited you to do pretty early on from starting to play the game. It's like, oh, play the 24 hours of Le Mans, and they wanted to actually do 24 hours.
Oh, man.
Driving.
It's ridiculous, man. And you know, a lot of people probably did that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a real event in real racing, right? So I understand why people would want to recreate that, but...
You didn't do it, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, good for you.
I have my patience for doing... I love games and I love playing games, but I often will pick playing five... You know, I would pick playing five 5-hour games over one 25-hour game.
Yeah, I'm the same.
And so the...
And definitely five 25-hour games over one 125-hour game.
Yes. I'm with you, man.
Yeah. And that's why, like, when I was playing Destiny Online last week, and I joined a group to do one of the strikes, and I picked one that was a few levels lower than me, just to be like, oh, yeah, I don't want it to be too hard. I don't want to spend too long on this. And we got through the level, and it was pretty fine. And then we got to the final boss, and all we could do was fight the infinitely spawning ads it was generating and caught us into a closet, basically.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I'm like, what is happening? Why is this a thing? And like, eventually, after like 40 minutes of just killing ads and killing ads and killing ads, I'm calling them ads of just like randomly spawned monsters that's making. Eventually, I'm just like, screw this guy. Like, I'm the tanky type character that has the most health. So I'm just going to, every time I respawn, I'm going to run through the mob of ads and then just fly around the room where the boss is and shoot at him for a while until I die. And then the other two guys just survive and kill ads, but can't actually make even, like, they can't even see the boss.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about. It's the guy who was all chained up.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That was my first.
I've been stuck in that closet too. Just get the hell out of that closet. They have this infinitely respawning, I don't even know what it's called, but it's like the chandelier of death.
Oh my God, that thing's horrible.
Yeah, it's awful. I hate it.
So I imagine that kind of thing will get I'm sure they're getting feedback on particular levels and stuff like that. But that's what we get for playing a very ambitious game in the first few weeks that it comes out, is that it will have its rough spots and things.
Sure.
But yeah, that's very cool. Other than that, I just started playing Shadows of Mordor on the suggestion of Georgia Dow, and actually our last week guest Kristen Borneman both were talking about Shadow of Mordor, so I picked it up. And again, a game that is imperfect but is a lot of fun. I've been very much enjoying that, so I'd encourage you both.
Yeah, I'm gonna check that out. Try that out.
I think especially, like Nigel had mentioned, that it seemed like something that he would enjoy, and now having played it, like the combination of stealthiness but not necessarily forcing you that if you stealth then you fail. Like every once in a while there'll be a, if you slightly screw up, that you immediately die, but for the most part you can be stealthy, but you can also just kick ass, and you can also just do the Arkham Asylum, fight 100 guys at once, or you can, you know, go and sneak around and poison the orc's grog when no one's looking. And it seems to have hit a really nice combination of making you feel empowered but also it being a payoff to be stealthy. So
it seems like a nice mix of like the Arkham games and the Assassin's Creed games, both of which I love. So anything that's a good mix of those, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be into. I just got to get a PS4 now.
That's the
gating factor on a lot of these games. I'm starting to fall behind, because even the ones like Destiny that are available for the older consoles, I kind of don't want to get them for the older consoles, but I just haven't actually got off my butt and slapped the $500 on the barrel head to get a PS4. So
yeah, you got to do it. You can do it now or you can do it later, I guess. It's just a decision you got to make. And don't they have, I thought they have a promotion as well that if you buy it digitally on PS3, Destiny, that you can upgrade before the end of the year to PS4.
I believe that is the case. But, you know, if you're going to experience the game, might as well. Like, one of the things that is the most remarkable, I think, about Destiny is how beautiful it is. So might as well experience it on the latest console and get something that's starting to actually push some of those graphical buttons that that the new console provides. I planned the whole time that I knew last Christmas, I was like, well, there's not enough games that I'm going to get it. And then I knew that I would not be able to survive to this Christmas without buying one. And then sure enough, ended up getting Destiny, basically pushed my hand. So
Yeah, I think for a lot of people.
I think that I haven't actually seen the VG charts, which is our periodic check how the various consoles are doing. But I imagine that the release of Destiny definitely caused a substantial bump on the various platforms. Although I'm kind of curious, you know, of course, not that we are the extreme sort of fanboy type, like, oh, anyone who doesn't buy this console is an idiot or whatever. But it's always interesting to see, you know, the relative success of the different platforms and their companies' sort of attempts to grow or shrink and these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. It looks like sales have picked up a little bit. I don't know that they're that much bigger on console hardware. It was, so week of 4th of October, it was 185,000 PS4s globally and 179,000 Xbox Ones.
Well, that's a big improvement for Xbox One, I think, since last time we were talking about this.
Yeah, I think Xbox One was doing worse before. The other thing, and I mean, this is something that's just so off my radar, I hadn't even realized it, is apparently FIFA 15 just came out, judging from the fact that all of the top four software spots are
different versions of FIFA 15.
Different versions of FIFA 15. But then 5 and 6 are Destiny on PS4 and Xbox One. So
turns out when you make a game about the most popular sport in the entire world, people will buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm really interested to see what happens in November, personally, because you know, when you look at the NPD charts, I really don't follow the VG charts because I know that's kind of some fuzzy math there, but for NPDs, the PlayStation 4 seemed to do really well in September. And I think because of Destiny and because there was this partnership between Sony and Activision, and that all made sense to me. The big question for me, though, is is that it's seemingly like the PS4 is winning the most crucial battle, which is the third party battle for third party games. People tend to be buying them on PlayStation over Xbox now, which is like kind of a reversal of what happened last generation. So when Call of Duty hits in November, is it going to sell more on Xbox, which they have those kind of marketing deals with Microsoft, or is it going to sell more on PS4 because of the user base is greater and people are tending to buy third party games on PlayStation now? So that to me is like the real determining factor this year, whether or not to see how much in trouble Microsoft is, and to see how healthy Sony is going into Christmas.
You know, I don't think these numbers are right for Xbox when they don't add up.
Yeah, they don't.
They're individual region ones.
No, they literally, the VG chart numbers do not actually add up.
It's a special feature. Yeah.
Because the actual individual column numbers are all much lower, even though the goal. So someone's just done the math wrong here. I think maybe there's an extra one on there. Like it should be.
It's just a shame. It's a damn shame that the NPDs aren't just publicly releasing their numbers like they used to a year or two ago. It's so ridiculous. It's one of the best things about Hollywood that they, you know, what's successful, you know, what's not successful. It helps people accountable. It keeps the public more aware of like what's going on. And also the retailers can see it adds more transparency to the industry. And it's just really unfortunate. And you're just left with like VG charts who just use, again, like very, very suspect, very fuzzy ways of calculating sales.
So NPD, my understanding is their business model is they like sell, they take the vendor and they sell it to the journalists, right?
Well, they sell them to publishers.
We always had the NPD reports kicking around the office at Radical. Like I think most game developers just subscribe to them.
Yeah,
for the company, but yeah, it's certainly not worth as a private citizen. Like the VG charts numbers are close enough, you know, you wouldn't want to.
Well, not when they're adding things that are off like 50,000.
Well, no, units. I mean, that's probably just, I think that's just a typo. Like, I think that someone just like had a brain fart when they were entering this table or something. Usually I would say you know, probably those individual column numbers are like within a few thousand or something like that. Certainly within like 10,000 for each of those columns. The global number being wrong is clearly just someone screwed up in building the spreadsheet or something like that.
Yeah, the fair thing I thought was going on for a long time was that the NPDs would release the actual sales numbers, I think, for the top 10 games in terms of units sold. And then the rest of them, like literally the thousands of other titles, and seeing how those did every month, those would only go to the folks that were subscribing to NPD and paying them, I don't know how many, like tens of thousands of dollars for those numbers. But yeah, it's a damn shame that we don't have that. And now what's even worse is that even in the NPDs, they're announcing that Sony was very, very excited about the download sales, like they're basically their PlayStation Store sales. But they wouldn't release any numbers. And it's obviously what's going on with Destiny. They sold very, very well on PlayStation Store, it seems, but nobody has any indication about how many units. Same with Steam. You know, it's like I'd love to see more transparency across all of these marketplaces so we can actually see who's doing what. You know, it's all just a big black box now.
Yeah, I've been playing around with buying stuff on the. I never didn't really do it on the PS3, but for whatever reason, on the PS4. Actually, you know, a lot of why I've been buying stuff on the PS4 on the store is because I can buy it and then it'll just like download and install and do all the updates and just like walk away and I put it into the thing into sleep mode and it'll keep doing it. Whereas I always had this feeling, and buying anything of the PS3 was sort of like having a dentist appointment. Like,
no, it was awful.
You know, it's a good idea eventually, but
oh, I know. Like, I would literally, I have free time. I'm going to turn on the PS3 and just let it update. That would be like an activity. Yeah.
It was dust. Terrible.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Terrible.
I think there's also, you know, people are just getting more used to the digital ownership. Like at the time of like the 360 and PS3 launch, like you didn't have any platforms that were like the App Store, the iOS App Store that people were kind of used to. Whereas now it's like, okay, yeah, having a PlayStation Network ID is no longer a unusual thing. Like everyone's got one and you sort of trust that like, yeah, if I buy this thing, then it's going to stick around. Whereas I think the PS3, Xbox 360 era, people were still kind of nervous about like, what does this actually mean if I buy this digital download game? Like, what am I, what am I getting for it? Yeah. I think the real shame with the digital downloads has been the fact that they're still full retail price, basically. Like, you know, that they've kind of,
dude, I love that,
because,
man.
Because they can't afford to piss off the physical retailers.
It goes deeper than that. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you're still getting the same game. And for somebody like me who's worried about the race to the bottom, like I want people to be paying, you know, full price for games. The other really interesting thing, I was really upset when both Xbox and, or both Sony and Microsoft didn't carry over your purchases from the PlayStation 3 store to PlayStation 4 and also for 360 to the new Xbox. I thought that really hurt, really damaged consumer confidence and being able to buy stuff just for the sake of buying it. I think we see numbers of people just, they buy so many more games than they end up playing. And, you know, at the end of the day, it helps developers because there's kind of a collector's aspect of it, or like, oh, I'll get around to it or whatever. Steam, you know, that you bought a game that you bought on Steam 10 years ago is going to continue to be around for the next 10 years. And so I was really upset about that, but it seems like, you know, people are getting over it. And then the last thing I like to say is, when it comes to Destiny, I'm one of those weird guys that I worry about Skynet. And when the internet is like completely destroyed, and you know, maybe I just have a little bit of electricity or some kind of generator, I can plug in my PlayStation 4 and put in my discs and play some games, you know, before the end of the world. But the sad reality is, I bought Destiny on disc, but the game doesn't even need the disc. All it is installing, you know, the same stuff that you're installing, downloading the game on PlayStation Network, and there's no you're not playing off the disc. There's no aspect of that. So you're basically just inconveniencing yourself if you want to switch around games and stuff like that. So I'm gradually kind of slowly having to go into the digital era when it comes to console games. But as much as I like to be able to look at my collection of box copies and stuff like that.
So if it's installed, then can I eject the Destiny disc and still play Destiny, or is it?
No, you need the disc. Like, it's basically just detrimental to have the retail version.
So the trade-off is that if you get the disc version, then you can then lend it to other people, but you need to have it in your...
I don't think... I think you're right. Yeah, you can lend it to other people. And then... that's a really good question. I don't know if it's tied to your account. But I think you're right. I think you can lend it to other people. Yeah.
Because they had that big PR thing, like when Microsoft was like, oh, we have this thing where you could resell your games and you can lend them digitally and stuff like that. But there were some restrictions. And Sony's like, here's how you lend games. And then they had this video of someone giving a game.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that's the only benefit to retail, is that you could actually sell it back. And then you can you can lend it to somebody, but you won't be able to play it while they're playing, obviously.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that that's a reasonable reason for the digital copies to be a little cheaper. Like, I think between not being able to resell, not being able to lend, and, you know, not having the physical disc, like, that's a couple bucks worth of value. I'd be way more willing to say, okay, if all digital games were like 10 bucks less than the box copies at launch, I would totally get everything digitally. But the, you know, the potential advantages of having the disc are enough that at the same price, it's still worth getting discs, even though I kind of don't want the discs anymore. Like, it's starting to be a little ridiculous to have a physical artifact. But I think that, you know, that difference is something different than the how much are people willing to pay for digital content race to the bottom kind of stuff. That I think that's just pure, like, the box game retailers would revolt if the publishers actually did that, and that even though they could sell them for $5 or $10 less at launch, they just can't afford to piss off the physical retailers yet.
It goes way deeper than that, and it's the trade-off in the short term is that it's what you're saying is totally reasonable, that hey, why am I getting this kind of this beautiful box and this disc, and it's still and then I could just download it off the store and it's the same price. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and I think you're right. I think a lot of people would do more digital if it was a little bit cheaper. I think what they're looking at is long term, is that they know in the next few years people aren't going to be buying Destiny 2 at retail. They're going to be buying it on the digital store. So if you set this precedent that, you know, maybe digital versions of these AAA games are $49.99, then you're stuck with $49.99 in 3 years. They want to basically lock people in at $59.99 for years to come.
Yeah, I can go both. I definitely see both sides of it as an app developer that's getting pressured by 99-cent and free stuff. Like, anytime someone can make something great and charge more for it, then that's better for people who can make that stuff so that we can have more people making better stuff. But also I think that like having played a little bit of a lot of games on Steam and things like that, where not necessarily the $2 ridiculous sales, but having games that are priced at like $40 and things like that, Valve has seen the price sensitivity of people's willingness to buy a game. Like, you know, you're saying people will buy a game and then maybe not play all of it. And that's a lot less of a, it's a lot less frustrating when the game is shorter, cheaper and things like that. So there's definitely both sides to that. But I think the thing that will be most interesting to see will be in a couple years, do the prices of older games go down and at what speed on digital, right? Like if you have a game that was early in the PS4, maybe a launch title or something like that, then I would think after 4 years, it would be reasonable to sell it for like $19.99, which is what, you know, sorry, we would get in retail that would mark down the copies, right?
It also seems like PlayStation Store and recently Xbox Live, they're starting to warm up to the idea of sales, right? They'll do flash sales and stuff like that. We're learning a lot from Steam. I'm just really nervous about the sale mentality. There's been an exhaustive number of articles about it, you know, in terms of people just wait for sales. And I just have a gut reaction to seeing one of the best games I think released in the past 5 years, like Hotline Miami, being sold for $2.50. I think is ridiculous.
Yeah,
I think it's a really unhealthy thing for the industry.
Yeah, I do think $10 off new is a much healthier and more sustainable model than like $5 for stuff that's 2 years old. Like that, you know, I mean, you don't necessarily get the choice between those two models. Probably you'd end up with both of them, but certainly the sale stuff is getting a little.
I think even $49.99 is too much to ask for. I'm all about the global proliferation of games and mass market acceptance of games, and that's part of the reason why we shipped on iOS to begin with. But I think $50, $60, well, plus tax, like, you know, you're getting close into $70 range for, you know, Shadow of Mordor. I think plus a $400 or $500 console is too much to ask for people. I think we tend to forget that. Sure, we maybe. The 20 or 30 million PlayStation 4 has been sold up until this point. That's just a drop in the bucket in terms of the global, the global population, and also just the population of people playing games on devices now. And so I think for the future, I'm hoping that either it's streaming services with subscription models I kind of envision a world where the PlayStation 5 is basically just a USB drive that you stick into your TV and it's streaming all this content, and hopefully at a cheaper price so we can get more people playing games, because it's just the idea of going to Best Buy, dropping $6-$7 for a game, $500 for a console, I think is just really detrimental to having more people play great games like Shadow of Mordor, Destiny, you know, what have you.
I'm pretty skeptical of the streaming stuff, though, just from a technology standpoint. Like, it seems like one of those things that you're fighting against various laws of physics in terms of, can I get my inputs to a remote server and get the video back. Maybe eventually you can get it as fast as things are now, but that's a pretty big hill to climb. And even by the time you reach the point that you can do it as fast as you can now, well, you know, what if now you want to use a like Oculus Rift to play your game with, and that needs latencies that are like a quarter of what our latencies are now in order to be usable. And
it's really the future. It's where we're going. It's inevitable. There are certain types of games like Dota, like Call of Duty or whatever, that's like really Twitch based that you're not going to want to play streaming, especially in the early ages. But games like, say, go back to the first game we're talking about, like Walking Dead, could easily be streamed and should be streamed as far as I'm concerned. And then also for Oculus, one of the really interesting things about streaming in Oculus, it could be the future, at least in the short term, is because these games, in order to do the stuff that Valve is experimenting with, it requires massive, massive amounts of CPU and GPU power that is way beyond what's available for consumers at this point. And actually streaming that content to the actual handset or the headset is actually one of the options that people are exploring. So I'm really excited about it, because it also It's going to, we don't have to worry about hardware limitations. We don't have to worry about piracy as much. Streaming games or streaming, in terms of streaming content, games are the only non-piratable versions of that. You will forever be able to stream and pirate music because it's all this linear stuff, like with music and TV and film and books. All linear content can be pirated for now to the end of the days. But because of the interactive nature of games, you need to have a singular stream for what you're experiencing. And it just gives me really a lot of hope in terms of what this industry can do in terms of expanding to a larger market. And also not having to worry about your game. Like our game is going to be destroyed in China. 90% or more people who are going to play Republic in China when it comes out there are going to pirate the hell out of it. And it's just really upsetting to me.
Yeah, I can definitely see that there's a, like you say, there's certain classes of games that would probably be the right approach for. Like I hadn't sort of considered that before, just because the games that I like for the most part are the ones that are sufficiently Twitch that they that they wouldn't work. I could totally see, in fact, I think I'd be more willing to take on some of like the Telltale games, for example. Like I said, the only one of them I played is the Monkey Island one, because I have a lot of affection for that series. I would actually probably be more willing to take on the other ones if they were part of some streaming service, you know, that I had like a, you know, $10 a month, like Netflix of games kind of thing where
that's the dream. That's the dream
where I could, you know, stuff like that. I could just be like, I'll give it a shot. If I don't like it, I'm not out any more than I would have been if I,
no installs, if I hadn't. No patches, none of that other crap. I mean, I think the big struggle with streaming is convincing folks like you, right? The guys who are playing, you know, more Twitch based stuff, like folks like me, honestly. But I think, we're going to, hopefully we'll gradually get to that point. One of the most eye-opening experiences I had was, I was recently in Japan, for some meetings in Tokyo Game Show. And, I've been playing with my friend Mark over there from 8-4, and we've been playing, I'm in Seattle, he's in Tokyo, and we've been playing Destiny all the time. And when I came to Tokyo, I brought my Vita with me and I did remote play from his house. He was playing Destiny on his big screen. I was with him on my Vita remote playing from my PS4 in Seattle and back. And yes, there was some lag, but it wasn't bad enough for us not to play together. I wouldn't do PvP because it's too Twitch based, but for like this, just like standard missions, no problem. And I just really felt like I was in the future. I felt like this is a really great, you know, potential future for the Vita. Not having to download games to stream into your, you know, a dual stick, you know, pretty good resolution device. It was just really eye-opening. We just kind of kept showing people in Tokyo and they're like, wow, you're in the future. You know, it was really cool.
So we just need to get the internet they have in Tokyo over here and we'll be good.
Oh man. Yeah. That's another huge barrier. I mean, there's so many, I can give you guys a full list of reasons why streaming right now sucks. Like, oh, you know, you can't play on airplanes. You can't play your games on, you know, while you're camping but all the kind of the same restrictions that you have or similar that you have to like Netflix right now. It's not the perfect solution, but, it's good enough for the masses to never want to buy a Blu-ray ever again.
Awesome. Well, I've just added streaming games into our list of future topics.
Oh man, yeah, call me up. You can tell I've got a lot to say about that.
And I'll put you down as the person for it.